potential for that. I have the potential for that. Everyone, City College is an open admission institution, which means that anybody who applies gets in. So what they did secretly is they put an intelligence test in the process of registering, such that anybody who wasn't bright enough to figure it out, they didn't get to go to City College. I'm the only one that knows this. And they'll probably put me in a dungeon for having told you. But what this means is, that you have to officially register to sit in this class. And to officially register, it doesn't mean just signing any tweet. It means that you are on that official list, or if you are not, you have to go into the office after class and have them admit you to the college and then register you for this class. You cannot do this yourself. Theoretically, you can, but practically none of us have ever succeeded. So what that means is, you both sign in here, okay, and if you're not on that official list, you figure something went wrong, you go to the office and have them officially register you. Wait, let me finish this before I go further. The reason this is, so next week your name should be on the official list and you'll just be able to check it off. If not, go back to the office and tell them, why didn't you register me? We need to do this for two reasons. Reason one, because this is the way that this happens. We get paid by the state for who's sitting here. So every time you come, it helps City College, it pays City College. Secondly, if something happened, an earthquake or something, and you were sitting in this class and you weren't officially supposed to be in this class, we would have great liability issues. The insurance company would say, what, you had somebody injured in your class and it wasn't a student? We don't pay for that. You shouldn't have had that in your class. So understand this, and probably other reasons too, those that do I know about. So please make sure that the registration happens somehow.
I'd like to say something about this. Ever since they changed the system to make it almost impossible, I've been complaining. I know Melissa Moreno, that's the whole thing. I've known her since we were students. She thinks it's just perfect the way it is. So I went to the trustees. They also are blowing it off. But maybe if a few more of us would contact the SBCC trustees, just Google SBCC trustees and tell them this is not an acceptable system.
Okay, so the suggestion, and again, I didn't make it because I like my job. is Google SBCC trustees and tell them how difficult it was for you to insinuate yourself into through this maze. Morgan?
You can do it as an anonymous letter to the New York Times.
You can do it as an Michael, and then you get
here. Yeah, I went through the process at the beginning, actually a little bit before. It took maybe 10 minutes and probably 4 minutes for me to get an
ID. Yeah. I take another class where it is actually
and it's free.
Okay. But anyway, please do register. And if you aren't on that official list, then if you aren't on the list of 100 so far that are official, then you have to register with the office.
Carl?
Well, thank you, Carl.
I just want to point out that you don't have to do this every semester. If you register as a student and you take classes each semester, you remain a student.
Okay, so there are two stages to the registration, as far as I understand it. One, you got to get into the college, and then you can register for classes more efficiently. Pepele.
But not 3 months. Over and over and over. online and in the town.
I didn't hear, I don't understand.
You know, mine and Superman, you have to pay.
It's a fee base.
But this one, mine is not a fee.
Correct. So there are different.
I couldn't find a listing online.
Yeah, as for the fact that we're buried in the schedule and it's totally confusing, schedule as a whole would be a question. Bernie, and then we gotta go. Well, we got
why don't you teach class next year how to fill out these forms?
All right. I assume, I don't want to have to go through this every week. I assume that you're on board or will get on board. Thank you, Lisa. This is Lisa Draper, who's been trying to herd the cats. As I told her in an email or a phone call the other day, it's especially difficult because you're intelligent cats. You're very good. Going in every direction. All right, anyway, hello with it, and let me find out where I am and what I'm supposed to do. Okay, next week we have a special guest, a man named Craig Chalquist, who will become an instructor in the spring in the SEL program, in this program. But whom I wanted to sit in front of class with and interview, given what I had read on his resume and what he proposes to teach. I think you'll find him an extraordinary person. I talked to him on the phone. He's a really nice person, too. But when you look at his resume, you think, oh my God, why does he want to teach here? he's going to talk to, amongst other things that he knows about, he'll talk to us about mythology and how to tell stories in a way that uses mythology to affect your audience. He'll also talk to us about echotherapy, using nature as a therapeutic tool and what we know about it and how it works and who it works for, etc. He's an expert in echotherapy. And he's got a bunch of other stuff he did too. When I read from his resume, you won't believe it where he's been. He's now associate provost at Pacifica. He was formerly a full professor at California Institute of Integral Studies and before that at JFK in the Bay Area. He's really done it all. So that's Greg Chalquist next week. If you are an artist or have an artistic bent, you might want to be brave enough to bring in your art on our last class, which I think is November 9th. It will be another one of our art fairs, and they've really been very successful. People bring in stuff and put it around the room, and we go around, we look. You know, we'll do other things in that class too, but it'll be an opportunity for you to display.
I think it's the third Friday. Ninth is Veterans Day, isn't it?
No, the 11th is always Veterans Day, isn't it?
But they used to celebrate Friday, don't they?
I don't know. If they do, I just looked at the schedule. If it isn't, if our last class isn't November 9th, then we'll adjust.
Okay.
But I think it is. Okay, let's talk about mindfulness a little bit, and then we'll sit, and then we'll go into the lesson for today. So, how do you develop this witnessing perspective? First of all, what is this witnessing perspective? Every time you shift your attention from what you're caught up in to your breathing, you take a step back from what you're caught up in, and you can, for a moment, perceive that that was a thought that I was caught in. That was a feeling, that was a sensation that absorbed in me. But now that I find my breathing, I can feel or see that thing, experience that thing without being caught up in it. So every time you do this, you take a step back and you witness what you were formerly engaged in completely, formerly absorbed in. The problem is, in the next moment, you get absorbed in something else. And the typical way we walk around is our attention goes somewhere and we get totally absorbed in that thing, and then the next moment our attention goes somewhere else and we get totally absorbed. The next moment we go somewhere else, we get totally absorbed. So we walk around from absorption to absorption to absorption to absorption, and we're not aware that our attention is moving or that we're absorbed. So we need to wire in an ability that isn't native to us. It's not something that we are born with. It's something that we have to learn. And that ability is the ability to stay in that person over there and not become absorbed in the things that we experience. That involves detachment from these things and also a steadiness of attention, such that attention becomes under our control as opposed to moving automatically, and becomes steady as opposed to moving. And this takes a lot of practice. When people first start to meditate, what happens is we think about what we are experiencing. Oh, I'm having a thought. Oh, I'm having another thought. Oh, there's a sensation. Oh, there's a feeling. So we're partly mindful because we're aware of what we just experienced. But we're staying in thought. We're using thought to explore the other things. We're thinking about this, we're thinking about this, we're thinking about this, but we've never really taken a step back. To take the step back and establish this steady, aware, but unabsorbed perspective, we need to do something. We need to train, we need to wire in an ability into the brain. And something we need to do is to consciously shift attention, to consciously take attention from where it is and put it where we want it to be. And then allow it to stay there, which it won't. We'll go back to absorption, and then we bring it back again, and then it goes back to absorption. And over time, we become more adept at first more quickly coming out of absorption in these things, and secondly, staying where we want to be, which is in a wide open awareness in which things happen. Now, it's easy to think about that, to visualize that, but to experience that is not so easy. So that's where the, as Chuck and Trumpa put it, the spiritual manual labor comes in, where we have to over and over and over and over and over, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, again, keep returning attention to the breathing and opening up and getting absorbed and returning attention to the breathing and opening up. And over time, in one particular sitting and in many sittings, there comes the ability to, for at least a little while, stay with the breathing, stay wide open, and notice the drama rather than crawling up on stage and being absorbed in it. So that's as clear as I can make it with words about how to do this. So if you're going to sit for 10 minutes, and you spend 9 minutes and 50 seconds lost in thought, that's par for the course. It's a good session. But for 10 seconds, you actually realize, hey, where's my breathing? Here's my breathing. Ah, there's my breathing. Gee, I'm such a good meditator. Back in the every moment that you come out of absorption and reestablish, take a step back and reestablish your witnessing perspective, that's a moment of mindfulness. And over time, those moments of mindfulness get strung together into an ability. And that ability turns out to be slightly useful in life. Just like that. So having said that, all that elephant manure, Fritz Perls used to call this stuff elephant shit. But it kind of feed the mind enough so the mind is satisfied for a while, so it'll let go a little. So the alpha and the omega instruction, as you heard me say so many times, and really the only instruction that's necessary is come back to your breathing with your attention. Don't try to change it, but if you can't feel your breathing, you're lost in thought. If you can feel your breathing, you're at least somewhat present to your experience. If you can't think your way into it, all you do is come back to your breathing, come back to your breathing, come back to your breathing, and then you'll be able to notice things and your breathing at the same time. Let's wait till the folks come in and then we'll sit.
Do you have a theory or idea why we're not wired that way?
It certainly is useful in life. I think that it's a brain maturation problem, just off the top of my head, and that it's a sophisticated brain operation such that we should become wired that way by life experience, but somehow it hasn't made it. There hasn't been a mutation such that you start that way. Certainly people around the world are getting to know this more and more, and younger people are getting to practice this. But whether this will end up in the genome or not, or whether it'll have to be acquired, I don't know. It's a great question. If you see Dan Siegel walking down the street, drag him into class and we'll ask him. You know, he might be the kind of person who can answer that question.
All right.
So here we go. So we're going to sit for 10 minutes. In this 10 minutes, just do three things. One, breathe. Don't forget to breathe. Breathing is very good. Just notice how you're breathing. Don't need to change it at all. Second, soften and open. Just let yourself soften and open. Head, heart, body, spirit, whatever. Just soften and open. And third, notice your breathing and whatever else is taking place. I'll ring the bell in 10 minutes. Soften, breathe, soften, open, notice. For people who are just arriving,
we signed it.
Please, everybody, make sure you sign it each time you come. So, two comments on the mindfulness. One, there are no distractions when you sit. It's just stuff to be aware of. So if at the beginning there was a bunch of noise, and if that disturbed you, you should have not only noticed the noise, but also your disturbance. And going, oh, how interesting. Look at how much the environment affects my internal environment. That's interesting. Maybe I can, next time that happens, instead of getting all upset about it, maybe I can just include it in my meditation and go, oh, I see God has a cell phone. Understand? So everybody gets upset when in groups, every group, their cell phone will go off, you know. And I just kind of use it as, like Thich Nhat Hanh says, there are certain things you assign as triggers, so that every time they happen, you pause for a moment and go mindful, like sound of a bell or sound of flowing water. For me, sound of cell phone is always, and everybody's got a different ring, you know, it's all so pretty. But understand how the mindfulness helps here. It helps you to not get immediately caught in negative, unhelpful patterns. So they take people who are practicing this, you know, monks, and they take them to all these noxious environments to help them practice being calm and open in environments which would otherwise be aversive. If there's a jackhammer outside your window and you're trying to sleep, if you object to it in your mind, it will be hell, literally. But if you include it, you just say, oh, okay, jackhammer, God is loud today. then after a while, you go to sleep. I mean, even with, you know, because you're not, there's no resistance in you. You know what they say, no resistance, right? And the second thing, the second comment about mindfulness is, what's your first name?
Barry.
What Barry asked is, why don't we have this ability already? And I thought a little about it. Not, okay, when you sit in with meditation, you don't try to think something through. But if there's something on your mind, it will weave its way through your thought process, and you just allow that. That's called contemplation. So Barry asked us, why don't we have this ability? And I thought about it, and what came to me is, our human consciousness and the brain are constantly evolving. It's a very kind of, the cerebral cortex is a new structure evolutionarily, and all sorts of capacities are being developed in it. And I think this is just a capacity that is evolved enough so that we're just at the beginning of the evolution of that capacity. That's what I think. If you're going to come to mind, it's shifting the topic again. You're going to come to mind and supermind. You better get tickets quick, I think. Because I just found out that a whole bunch of those 400 tickets at the Garden Theater are probably going to be gobbled up by groups who want to, it's such an important topic, you know, what's happening to the youth. So buy your Mind and Supermind ticket while you still can, because I think maybe you're not going to be there after a little bit.
We mean gobbled up by groups, what does that mean?
I can't say more about it, because it's not for sure yet, but it looks like there are certain groups in the community that wants this information enough to buy large blocks of tickets.
Oh, business groups, right?
Whatever, I can't say that. They're big groups, okay. So buy your Mind and Supermind tickets now if you want, okay. I should have said this at the beginning of class last week, but I'll say it now, at the middle of class this week, which is, when you were younger, did you ever think to yourself, if I were just a little more conscious, if I were just a little more aware, self-aware, and if people in general were just a little bit more conscious, the world would be a totally different place? How many people had a thought or a similar thought to that? Raise your hand. Well, that's what you're doing here, and that's what this class is about. Raising our consciousness just a little bit, you know, and helping other people to similarly raise their consciousness. If people were a tiny bit more aware of the consequences of their actions on other people and the system in general, it would be a transformed planet. You know, and I don't think very much more awareness is necessary, just some. So that seems to be what many of us are doing with our lives, is trying to become more aware, self-aware, and trying to help other people become more aware, such that people can individually make good decisions collectively. but that's all not what I wanted to tell you about. Here's what I wanted to tell you about. By the way, I'm recovering from being ill, so my mind is not quite as fast as it usually is, and I'm kind of mellower, so that's why you might hear that my voice is a little nasal. But it's kind of nice to have to move at the speed that other people generally move at. Physically, I meant not mentally. Last week we made a map of consciousness, the things that people report that they have experienced. And I thought we might as well go for the most interesting one first, right? Which is the source level stuff. Is spirituality real, is the question. And it certainly is a worthwhile and huge question. A few thoughts I had about it, and then we'll start to explore what other people have said. First, I think we fall into three camps in this group and in general. And I would like to address all three camps seriously. Okay? So I'm going to attempt the impossible here, which is to say stuff about spirituality that nobody objects to, no matter where you're coming from. And not have it be complete watered down. We fall into three camps. The spiritually certain people who just know that it's true, and a bunch of us here have had experiences or have development from childhood such that we just know that there is a level that is not the physical level that informs, patterns, upholds, creates the physical level, and that's just a fact for many people here, but not for all of us. Second group of people are the atheistic, traditional scientific people. And they say, look, we look as far as we can, we look as little as we can, we look at human behavior as deep as we can, and we do not find anything other than what we find. And it just is, folks, and there ain't nothing behind it because this is all of it. And that other stuff is, well, we'll talk about what that other stuff might be. But for many people, this is reality, folks. I mean, no matter what you think about it, reality is reality, you know? And science describes reality, and that's the way it is. And then there's a third group of people that are kind of like, I don't know, kind of agnostic. That is it true or isn't it true, this spiritual stuff? So, for the second two groups of people, the people who are atheistic and simply scientific, orthodoxly scientific, and the people who are agnostic and not really sure, there are three ways that we can dismiss spiritual people's reports. Okay, we can attribute their spiritual certainty to three things. One, it is a necessary, because we are mortal, and there is something we cannot tolerate about realizing that we're not going to be here, that our time here is limited, that there is death. Okay? Because of that, we have to invent in our minds something to keep us sane. And so spirituality is a universal human delusion. It's a delusion that every culture has to come up with in order for the culture to remain viable. It's a delusion that people generally have to come up with in order to remain sane. So it's just the fact that all cultures everywhere have spiritual, have a spiritual component. That has to do with the fact that something about being a human, with human consciousness, that you have to invent this. That's one way that agnostic or atheistic people can not take spirituality seriously. Second way, now don't worry if you're a spiritual person, I'm going to argue against it first, then I'm going to argue for it. Okay? Great about 1 foot on each. Second is, if you're atheistic or agnostic, you can see spirituality as a product of suggestion. Whatever you think is going to happen, or whatever you think is the case, becomes the case in your mind. And we know this, that suggestion is unbelievably powerful. Those of you a couple weeks ago that read in Time magazine about the placebo, prescribing placebos, how many people read that? An article in Time? A few people. So it's the placebo effect is so strong that now you can buy something, the doctor can prescribe you something that says placebo on it. Right? And you go home and you take it and it works. And you know it's a sugar pill, but there's something about the doctor prescribing it and you taking it, the ritual of it, that makes it work, and sometimes tremendously powerfully. Suggestion is a huge force in our psychological world. And if you have from childhood been raised with the idea of spirituality, it's been suggested into you and now becomes a reality, you know? Or if you have had some sort of experience that convinces you that there is this spiritual level, then that experience is a suggestion that then persists. Or if you're in any culture and the spiritual ideas that infuse the culture talk to you, especially when you're little and you're very open and impressionable, then that becomes what you perceive. Suggestion becomes reality. You know, how you look at it becomes how it is for you. That's a second possible explanation for the fact that people have spiritual certainty when maybe there isn't any. Then there's a third level. Why do people say, who have these experiences, say they're more real than real? They're preternaturally real. They're just more real than this. They're not like dreams, they're like super reality. And these people have these experiences spontaneously. They have been doing drugs and doing ascetic practices, all this kind of thing. And they have these experiences that seem more fundamental than our usual life experience. Why does that happen? Why does it seem more, or people that have from childhood grown up with spirituality who say, my knowing is a deeper knowing, a different kind of knowing than the knowing of the things of this world. It's more genuine. So why do people have that experience? Maybe they have that experience because when they're having that experience, there's no sensory input. They're disconnected from their usual sensory apparatus, and so the experience becomes all the experience. So it has a reality that is greater than an experience that you have in this reality where there's all kind of sensory input keeping you from becoming totally focused on one thing. If all of your attention goes to something, it creates a certainty or a sharpness or a convincingness to the experience that's atypical. So that would be a third reason why people say these experiences are more convincing than this reality. It's because somehow their sensory input is not distracting them in any way from the experience. So why don't we just, because of those three factors, why don't we just, if we're agnostic or atheistic, why don't we just say, well, you know, it's because of delusion, or it's because of suggestion, or it's because of some abnormality of the way the experience is perceived, and that explains it. Why can't we just kind of like say, that's old thing, that's primitive thing, we're scientific now, we're beyond that. Well, I came up with a couple of reasons why it's probably important to keep your mind open about this. So I will detail those reasons, okay? First, because so many, Christine?
Sorry to bother you, but
Catherine, I'm sorry, Catherine.
Can you hold the microphone a little out because it's a little close and it's...
Oh, so is it better this way?
Yes, because you're getting the wind.
Oh, I'm getting like this? So I should go like that?
Quite loud.
Okay. Tell me, Catherine, is this better?
That's better.
Can you hear me? Can everybody still hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. So if I get, raise your hand or something. Catherine, you stand up if I get like this, which is not good. Bernie, what? Yeah.
Are you okay to talk at this point or just going to say?
Say again?
I want to say something, but I wasn't sure.
Wait, let's wait a little bit, okay? till I can get through these, and then we'll talk a little bit, and then we'll go further. All right, so why don't we just dismiss spirituality by these, because of these things that I've mentioned? First, because so many really smart people have said it is not fiction, it is so. And these are people who are not likely to be fooled. There are just so many brilliant people, some of whom were atheistic or agnostic and had some sort of spiritual experience, and went, now I see. I was blind, but now I see. You know, and when you talk to these folks, and I've talked to a lot of them, I think, you know, these people are smart as me or smarter than me. They're not apt to be, you know, boondoggled here. They're saying that you just don't understand until you understand. And, you know, so you have to listen to articulate people when they make a case. Second, people who have spiritual certainty say one of two factors has to happen for you, or else you're not going to understand this. Factor one is you have to have grown up with a familiarity with spirituality such that it just undergirds your life. And if you haven't had that growing up with this, then it's going to seem foreign to you. Or you have to have had some experience that convinces you that this is true. You know, like Jimi Hendrix said, are you experienced? What he was talking about was, it, you know, have you had an experience where you see another reality? And if you don't, then what you're going to do, either because you haven't grown up with it or you haven't had experience, is you're going to try to reduce what they're saying to something that fits into your worldview. Because our worldview is what keeps us stable. It keeps us secure. And if suddenly your worldview is shattered by something way outside it, it's very upsetting. So if we haven't had either faith from childhood or direct experience of spirituality, we're going to try as hard as we can to try to understand it given the world that we generally live in. So we don't have to give up a worldview, because it is an extremely frightening experience that you have a worldview. Another way, a more fancy way to say this is the ego wants to hold on. And it will find every way that it can to stay in control by downgrading anything that would threaten it. If you want to put it in those terms. Also, when another reason to take these spiritual reports seriously is when people describe them, they don't describe them in a way that people describe hallucinations or delusions or dreams. They're not like sort of kind of fuzzy. They're hyper-real. They're extremely well-defined. And they're talked about in very precise, even if words don't serve, in very precise kind of terms, in very convincing kind of terms. People who talk about these things do not sound like they're talking about delusion. They sound like they're talking about very real experience. They seem, I wrote the word pellucid, they seem more than lucid when they're talking. Okay. Not fuzzy-headed in any respect. Okay. Another reason to take this stuff seriously is so many different paths seem to lead to the same kinds of experiences. So many different paths seem to lead to spirituality. So I wrote down just across cultures and across time. So I wrote down some of them, just off the top of my head. Meditation, prayer, psychedelics, near-death experiences, ascetic disciplines like long fasts, whirling like the dervishes do, spontaneous experiences that happen out of the blue to people. They just kind of seem to converge on a set of understandings that, even though they come from disparate roots, seem to come to the same place. I'm not saying you have to believe all this. I'm saying that if you're a bright person, you have to hold all these things in your mind. When an example of the convergence of these different routes to spiritual understanding is when Stan Grof was working with psychedelics and then with holotropic breathwork, but especially when he was first working with psychedelics, stuff was happening. People were reporting stuff in Czechoslovakia back in those, in the 50s, you know, that they were reporting this stuff that he had no frame of reference for. This was not stuff in Czech culture. Suddenly they were talking about stuff that we now know to be like Eastern spirituality kind of stuff, or indigenous spirituality kind of stuff. And he was like, what? What are these things? What are they talking about? You know, they're not talking about their childhoods, they're not talking about their birth process, they're talking about something, I have no idea what it is. So he went looking for reports of the same kind of stuff that people were spontaneously saying in their psychedelic sessions, and he found a very strong correspondence in Eastern spirituality. So he became very interested in Hinduism, Taoism, Buddhism, and held conferences where people who were expert in these Eastern approaches to consciousness were dialoguing with psychedelic researchers. I went to one of those conferences, the first International Transpersonal Conference in Iceland in 1972. It was unbelievable. It was these remarkable people from the worlds of Eastern religion and, well, religion in general, and researchers. I actually went to several such conferences. But the point is that there seemed to be that people from the spiritual, and it turned out to be not just Eastern spirituality, it turned out to be spirituality in general. The spiritual people had no trouble talking about their view of things with the people coming from these consciousness expanding areas. They seem to be talking, be able to talk to one another really easily. They seem to be talking about the same thing. That's kind of convincing when people who come from such different backgrounds converge in the same place. Further, another possible reason why spirituality might actually exist. When people have these experiences, they generally don't go crazy. They generally don't act in bad ways. In fact, they tend to have their lives transformed in incredibly helpful ways. You know, whether they have a spontaneous mystical experience, or whether they have an experience on a psychedelic, or whether they have an experience in church. When they have certain direct experiences of spirituality, they change remarkably. And they change remarkably and permanently in a positive direction. So these experiences are extremely helpful, which gives them some great credibility. They aren't like delusions which lead you astray. They're realizations which bring you further along in a positive direction. How many of you have read or are reading Michael Pollan's newest book, How to Change Your Mind? Raise your hands if you are. Does anybody have that book here, by the way? Because I was going to read from it today. I'll read from it in 2 weeks.
What's it about?
You can have it on my computer.
You have it, actually? Okay. Yeah. I might use it, but not right yet. Okay, go ahead. Thank you.
What's it about?
It's about, I'm going to talk about it a whole bunch, even though there's... It may be Robert Bernstein cautioned me about that book, and so I'm reading it with a different set of lenses. I'm about halfway through it now. He's saying that he talks about it, but in a sense he hasn't experienced it, so he kind of talks about it not from the outside. And I'm reminded of the comment that Ken Kesey made about Tom Wolfe's wonderful book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. How many of you have read that book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test? Good for you. So what Kesey said when asked about it, this is all about Ken Kesey and Larry Pranksters and psychedelics back in those days. So when Kesey was asked about it, he said about Tom Wolfe, he knows where it is, but he doesn't know what it is. And we'll see whether Pollan's book is of that same ilk. But in any event, what Holland is saying in the half of the book I've read so far is that people who have these experiences go through dramatic and positive changes in their personalities, and these kind of changes are kind of unprecedented. We don't generally see these in psychotherapy. We do see these in sometimes what Peter does, you know, which is if you do real depth work, then you can see amazing life changes. But the usual kinds of work we do, you see gradual change rather than, and also not huge amount of change. You see people getting a little better or gradually better, but you don't see people being transformed in one afternoon. You know? But people have mystical experiences, even spontaneous mystical experiences, not even spontaneous, but spontaneous mystical experiences. They go to the Grand Canyon, like a friend of mine did, they see Jesus, and they're like a different person for the rest of their life. What? This is, psychology doesn't know how to deal with this. This is not a usual therapeutic outcome. Okay, last point. One other reason that spirituality might be, should be taken seriously as a possibility is human consciousness is strange in that you can readily understand how creatures became more conscious because it helped them survive and procreate. If I can imagine what's going to happen next, I can prepare for it. So it's clear that as consciousness has developed, creatures have become better able to adjust to a changing environment, better able to survive, and the epitome of that, is human beings who we don't have any of the natural advantages of a lot of other creatures. We're not faster, we don't have tough skins, we don't have big fangs, but we exist everywhere in the globe and very, very successfully at the expense of other creatures. But we are able to adapt to environments in a way no other species is because we can use consciousness the way we do. But there's a flavor of human consciousness that seems to go beyond, that seems to leave the physical plane and go beyond what would be necessary for survival and procreation, even getting better and better and better at it. There's something about the flavor of human consciousness that is what I call orthogonal. It's at 90 degrees to the physical plane. Somehow it reaches, it points toward or climbs toward something that is entirely different than physical consciousness, than physical life. It just leaps upward from this plane of existence. And if you don't believe that, you listen to Beethoven's Fifth or Ninth Symphonies, and you ask, did he write those just because they would be well received and put food on his table? You know, do great artists create the art they do because that will get them tenure, or that will make them popular? Or is there something else investing those efforts that's beyond what would be required to be successful in this world? Is human consciousness leaping somewhere else? Has it developed enough to be moving to something beyond that in which it developed? I can't say more than that in my current fuzzy state, but you understand what I mean. There's something about the way we understand ourselves and the world now that seems to be transcendent. So, what do we do if we're agnostic or atheistic with this seeming conflict between these two ways of looking at things? This is it, and there's a level of spirituality underneath this or above this. What do we do with that conflict? Logically, it's a conflict. I think what we do is what Marianne Woodman suggests. We hold the tension of the opposites. We take both illogical possibilities that seem to clash, thesis and antithesis, and we just hold them in our awareness, in our mind, in our heart, until a synthesis appears. We just, instead of being uncomfortable with the tension between things that seem to be incompatible, we just grow to open so we can embrace both those ways of looking at things at the same time, and we watch what happens as that tension creates a third understanding, a superordinate understanding. Mary Whitman isn't the only person who said this. Of course, she's a Jungian, but Carl Jung himself said this. He said, when he was asked about, a woman wrote a letter to him saying, I don't know what to do, there's a great tension in me between my role as a wife and mother and my desire to be an intellectual. And I don't know how to fit those two together. Which one should I choose? And he said, you don't choose. You hold these things inside you until something, some way emerges to synthesize them or to realize the import of both of them. And I found that to be incredibly useful way to look at things. When there are when there's conflict in me, instead of trying to solve the conflict, to just open up to experience it in all its glory until it creates something beyond itself. Anyway, what I want to do now a little bit is look at some reports of mystical experience, and then I will abruptly, and for no good reason, change our focus entirely, because I discovered something this week that I just want to show you. So I'm going to try the new projector, and for the last 20 minutes or so, I'm going to show you something that's not related to what I've been talking about, but that I just want you to see, okay? And so we'll come back. We're not going to leave mystical experience. And spiritual experience in general. We're going to come back to it. But I'm just going to do it for a little while longer. Okay. So I need Michael Pollan. And I actually need page 68 and then 70 and 71. Do you have that?
Yeah.
How great. Thank you. Oh, what's your first name? And
Bob. I don't think I'm a little confused about spirituality. And particularly like where love would fall on, is it spiritual or is it the here and now?
I am about to, I'm going to read something that's going to address that right now, Bob. Synchronous. But yeah, that's a good question.
I don't know if this is the same page. It's my page 68.
Yes.
Is that it?
Yes.
That it?
Yes. Huh? Okay, so first I need that, and then we'll go to 7071. Okay. Thank you. Okay. So this is a 50 thanks. This is a 50-something philosophy professor named Richard Boothby, who volunteered for the experiment at Johns Hopkins that happened recently, where they took psychedelically naive people who had never had a psychedelic, who wanted to experience it. They gave them a high dose to see whether they would have mystical experiences, and many of them, in fact, did. So Boothby was one of those people, and here's what he said. At the depth of this delirium, I conceived that I was either dying, or most bizarrely, I was already dead. All points of secure attachment to a trustworthy sense of reality had fallen away. Why not think I'm dead? And if this is dying, I thought, then so be it. How can I say no to this? At this point, at the greatest depth of the experience, I felt all my organizing categories of opposition, dreaming and wakefulness, life and death, inside and outside, self and other, collapse into each other. Reality appeared to fold in on itself, to implode in a kind of ecstatic catastrophe of logic. Yet in the midst of this hallucinatory hurricane, I was having a weird experience of ultra sublimity. Ultra sublimity, that is super sublime. And I remember repeating to myself again and again, nothing matters. Nothing matters anymore. I see the point. Nothing matters at all.
It's just a bit more.
At the same time now, this is Michael Pollan talking. At the same time I was interviewing Richard Boothby and his fellow volunteers, I was reading William James' account of mystical consciousness in the varieties of religious experience in the hope of orienting myself. And indeed, much of what James had to say helped me get my bearings amid the torrent of words and images I was collecting.
Let me see if I can see this.
It's important to note that James didn't have the experience. That's,
right. Yeah. Okay, so let's see. Okay, what is, I don't know what it is yet. So. Okay, there we go.
Now, I want to skip that. I'm going to skip a little bit. Okay. So, John Hayes, a psychotherapist in his 50s, who was one of the first volunteers at Johns Hopkins, said, "It felt like mysteries were being unveiled, and yet it all felt..." So this is a psychotherapist in his mid-50s. "It felt like mysteries were being unveiled, and yet it all felt familiar, and more like I was being reminded of things I had already known. I had a sense of initiation into dimensions of existence most people never know exist, including the distinct sense that death is illusory, in the sense that it's a door we walk through into another plane of existence, that we're sprung from an eternity to which we will return." Which is true enough, I suppose. This is Pollan talking. It's true enough, I suppose, but to someone having a mystical experience, such an insight acquires the force of revealed truth. So many of the specific insights gleaned during the psychedelic journey exist on a knife edge, poised between profundity and utter banality. Boothby, an intellectual with a highly developed sense of irony, struggled to put words to the deep truths about the essence of our humanity, revealed to him during one of his psilocybin journeys. This is Boothby. "I have at times been almost embarrassed by them, as if they give voice to a cosmic vision of the triumph of love that one associates derisively with the platitudes of Hallmark cards. All the same, the basic insights afforded to me during the session still, for the most part, seem compelling." What is the philosophy professor's compelling insight? Quote, "Love conquers all." So, thank you, Ken. For now, so this is not, I don't want to talk about psychedelics. I want to talk about what they lead to and how what they lead to seems to be parallel to what all these other ways of going deep into oneself and reality lead to. So the idea that the spiritual basis of reality is love. This is not restricted to people who take psychedelics. This is something that you read about in all of the spiritual literature, right? If you've experienced it, I guess it's a reality. If you haven't experienced it, it's kind of a mystery. Oh, one last thing before I switch. I'm going to come back to reading descriptions of mystical experiences, and then we're going to talk about them further. But in terms of where many of us are at the present with this question, Edward Sharif Curtis, E.S. Curtis, the guy who did the American Indian photographs in sepia that so many of us have seen in the most familiar Native American photographs. One of my favorite photographs that Curtis did was of a Lakota medicine man named Slowbo, and its global silhouetted against the sky, holding up a calumet, peace pipe. It's actually a spiritual pipe. And he's holding it up to this guy, this great big guy, holding this pipe up to the sky, and the caption to the picture is prayer to the mystery. Prayer to the mystery. So if this is a wonderful open mystery for you, then you're in good company. So is there a comment or two in about 2 or 3 minutes, and then I want to take us to a very different and much more prosaic place. So we're going to start here, we're going to go here. So,
thank you very much. Do people who take the psychedelics, I haven't done it yet, so.
Yeah.
Do people who take it, they just get at some point where they just stop and they don't need to take it anymore? Or is it a constant?
There's a real difference between taking something at a party or have a good time and taking something for serious spiritual or personal exploration. People that kind of take low doses just have a good time, they just do that, I guess. A lot of kids doing that. But if you do this in a supervised, serious context, which we don't have in this culture, it's too bad, because in other cultures that use these things, there's a lot of preparation, there's a lot of guidance, there's a lot of community support, there's a lot of debriefing. It's a whole big deal. It's an initiatory rite or a rite of passage. It's done culturally supported, and it produces great positive change in people. If you do that, oftentimes one is enough. What's the guy on, didn't even see the show, Larry Hagman. What Larry Hagman said is, it's like a spiritual root canal. This is not something that you would do casually, and it's not something that you would want to do frequently. So there was an psychedelics are just a currently available and a culturally hot way of talking about something beyond them. It's just one route to what we're talking about. I don't care so much about the psychedelic. I care what it points toward. I care what the finger is pointing toward. Okay.
So, I think she was asking about, is it sustainable? Do you keep that? Do you stay in that zone?
Next question. Oh, okay. That was my second question.
That's what I...
Yeah, you don't stay in that zone, you go down. But that experience transforms your life. When Moses goes to the top of the mountain, okay, in the Ten Commandments in the movie we all saw, when Moses goes to the top of the mountain, he comes back a different person. People have this, St. Paul on the road, he's a different person after his spiritual experience. So Morty and then Cannon and I've got to shift us or we won't have time for this. So, Morty.
I would say that perhaps these conflicts of understanding in terms of consciousness, this film I saw Monday night, about Toad, the oil of a toad that goes back hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years and just absolutely splits your mind and separates you from everything and makes you a part of the cosmos. It makes what we deal with minutiae. It has no import whatsoever because it's so far beyond what we have an understanding of as consciousness.
Okay, so another way to put this is these experiences,
the healers in South America who utilize this, that's what they depend on, the same as the Indians.
So these experiences, however you have them, they go beyond the usual way that our mind works.
Precisely.
Ken.
So partial answer to that question. I think that people say that if you're using LSD or psilocybin or some other psychedelic, that gives you the transformation, but you can't, without that psilocybin on another time, you can't go back to that mystical experience on your own. However, if you reach the same place using mindfulness and other Eastern traditions, those people go back to exactly the same place at will. When they get trained. Does that sound right?
Yeah, it's so beautiful, and it reminds me to say something to you that I was going to say to you. which is, if you have a spontaneous mystical experience, or if you have one on a psychedelic, or if you have one by fasting, or if you have one when you're very ill, or if you have a near-death experience, you know, sometimes these experiences can be looked at, especially the ones that come from psychedelics, as a window opens, and you see a reality that you don't generally see. And then when you come down, or when you come out back from whatever experience you had, the window doesn't close entirely. It stays ajar somewhat. But it's a window, okay? You're still where you are. You could, you know there's something beyond because you've seen it, but you just got a glimpse through the window. If you want to walk through the door, if you want to be able to go back and forth to that other reality, then you have to do the work. Okay, it's not something that, sometimes, very occasionally, a spontaneous or a mystical experience or a mystical experience on a psychedelic will open a door that stays open. But a door you can go back and forth, but generally not. Generally, if you want to have that reality as something accessible to you in your life, you need to do the work to make a state into a trait. You need to open yourself up in a more permanent way. So Amy, and then I got to move us, or we're going to be here until 3 o'clock this afternoon.
Okay, so there's a neuroscientist named Dr. Joe Dispenza, and he is currently doing a lot of research where he's doing brain scans. He'll take 1,000 people for a week-long kind of a workshop, and every day there's more meditations. There's standing meditations, walking meditations, lying meditations, and the last 2 days they go into a trance kind of a state, and they're healing. He's seeing depression, Alzheimer's, blindness, tumors, crazy stuff. So but he's got some books, Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself, and currently now he's Becoming Supernatural. So he's trying to connect the biology of it with the rest of it.
But what he's doing is he's creating in this culture the kind of setting that these experiences are in other cultures. It's creating a very special environment and a lot of group support, a lot of preparation, a lot of debriefing. There's more to be said about that, but Ram Dass, after having done all that acid, realized that if I want to stay here, I better sit my butt on the cushion and start meditating, and he's been doing it ever since. Okay, so here we go, I think. If I can get this thing to operate right. So we're going to need you. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, great. You can pull that all the way up. So we're going to need darkness in this room. We're going to need three sides here. What is it? So I'm going to show you a 14-minute video from a 10, it's a 10X talk that was given recently in Sausalito. And the woman who gave the talk is a Berkeley professor named Allison Gopnik. And Allison Gopnik is famous for two things. First, she's famous because she's a developmental psychologist and she works with children, trying to understand how children understand the world. So she's trying to understand how children's minds work. And what she has found has made her remarkably in demand by the people who do artificial intelligence developments. So she frequently dialogues with people who are trying to make smart machines, because what she finds about how children work seems to be what would make machines smarter. And so she goes to, what she has learned is very useful in trying to make machines actually intelligent. So children are teaching the smartest machines in the world how to be smart.
Yeah. So here we go. This is our new projector, which actually makes what's on the screen actually visible. Never say that being a total pain in the ass isn't a good thing. I've been bothering people about this long enough, so it finally happened. I'm sure I'm not the only person. So, here goes.
Let's be honest, you operate pretty...
Great, so glad to be here. Anyone who's spent time with young children, let's say 3 or 4 year olds, and see how crazy they are and the weird things that they say, has a sense of how creative even the very youngest, especially the very youngest children are. But it's only really recently that we've begun to understand in a scientific way just how creative young children are and why they're as creative as they are. Now, over the past 20 years or so in my lab, we've shown that even very young children use a lot of the same learning mechanisms as the very smartest scientists. So they look at patterns of events in the world, they make up hypotheses, they do experiments, which we call getting into everything, and they figure out the theories about how the world works. Now, how can we show that children are so smart? We've done it using very simple devices like this. This is the Blicket detector. The Blicket detector is a little box that lights up and plays music when you put some things, namely Blickets, on it, and not other things. Now, actually, the secret is there's a graduate student behind the curtain who's pressing a button, but fortunately, the kids never figure that out. And just by showing children this machine and trying to get them to figure out how it works, we've shown that they can analyze statistics, understand conditional probabilities, work out abstract logical structure. They're amazingly smart, and they're also amazingly creative, sometimes more creative than adults. To show this, let's do a little Blicket detector experiment with you. Here is my Blicket detector, and I put these blocks on it. I put the D block on the detector, and the detector lights up 3 times in a row. I put the E block on the detector, and the detector doesn't light up. And then I put the D and F blocks on together, and the detector does light up. And the question for you is D a Blicket or not a Blicket? Okay? No? How about E? No? How about F? Okay, great. So, as I expect, this audience is just as smart as Berkeley undergraduates, but not as smart as 4-year-olds. Because you also saw this sequence of events. You saw that A, B, and C don't make the machine go, A and B together don't, B and C together don't, but A and C together do. Now, if you saw this sequence, you might think, oh, wait a minute, the machine works differently than I thought. It isn't that individual blocks or Blicket make it go or not, it's you need a combination of 2 blocks to make it go. And that unusual creative hypothesis about how the machine works, that it requires these combinations, would lead you to interpret this sequence of events differently. So now, if you saw this sequence, you'd be more likely to say, oh, maybe D and F are both Lincolns. Maybe the machine works in this unusual way. And what we did was we took Berkeley undergraduates and we took four-year-olds, and we gave them exactly the task that I just gave you. We either gave them information that pointed to this individual principle, the obvious one, the one that comes to mind right away, or this sort of unusual creative possibility of the combination, and then we gave them the test that we showed you. And here a four-year-old actually doing this task, so you can see just how complicated it is.
What should we call this one?
Square.
And what should we call this one?
Ball.
Ball. Sounds good. Okay, so let's see what happens when we put triangle on the machine. Are you ready? Let's see. Look at that. The machine did not turn on. Let's see what happens when we put triangle on the machine again, okay? Look, the machine did not turn on. Now let's see what happens when we put triangle on the machine one more time, okay? Let's see. Look, the machine did not turn on. Now let's see what happens when we put square on the machine, okay? Look at that. The machine did not turn on. Okay, now let's see what happens when we put triangle and ball on the machine together. Look at that. The machine turned on. Now let's see what happens when we put triangle, square, and ball all on the machine together. Are you ready? Let's see. Look at that! The machine turned on! Okay. Now let's see what happens when we put triangle and ball on the machine together. You ready? Let's see. Look! The machine turned on! So Scarlett, do you think that a triangle is a blanket or not a blanket? A blanket. And do you think that square is a blanket or not a blanket?
No.
And do you think that ball is a blanket or not a blanket?
Yeah.
Okay, so Scarlett, which of these should we use to make my machine turn on? Those two?
Okay, so I like showing this video part because I like showing cute children. But even more, because if you're like me, when you were watching that, you were thinking to yourself, what the, was it like the square one, or was it the circle one that went on? It's a really complicated sequence of events, Archie. So if you were feeling stupid, you are not the only one. It's hard to keep track of even for adults. But you could see how focused that little four-year-old was on what was going on. And she actually got to that creative, unusual solution to the task. What we discovered was that very characteristically, when we did this with the four-year-olds, they solved it in this unusual way. When we did it with our beloved Berkeley undergraduates, they almost never got to the creative solution. They always gave you the obvious solution. They gave the obvious answer, the one that was, you know, most likely to be on the test. They didn't see this other possibility. And we've seen this in other experiments that we've done as well. Now, how does the kind of teaching that we usually see in schools fit into this kind of incredibly powerful natural learning? To try and look at that, we did another experiment. Okay, and in this experiment, what we did was we showed the children a different kind of machine. This is a little toy that does different things when you activate the toy. And what we did was show the children a series of actions on this toy, and then the toy either made music or didn't make music. So the experimenter would squish the toy, squeeze the bulb, and the children, right? And the toy would make music. Or the experimenter might pull the handle and squeeze the bulb and pull the ring, and the machine would make music. Now, the children saw 10 different sequences like this. Sometimes it made music or not. If you were looking at those two examples, and I now ask you, how can you make it play music? The obvious thing you could do is just do exactly what the experimenter had done. But there's a more creative solution to this. If you were looking carefully, you'd see that what the first action didn't matter. You might pull the handle, you might do something else. The machine still played. But you had to squeeze the bulb and pull the ring. So the more efficient, more intelligent, more creative solution is to say, it's just the last two actions. And what we did again was do exactly this experiment with four-year-olds.
Yes, isn't it crazy?
Yeah, I've never played with it before. So you know what's funny about it? It plays music. But I don't know how to make it from easy yet, so I thought that what we could do, and we could try to make it easy, we can figure it out, okay? Might help me to see if you've got what makes it dope. All right, so let's meet again. We'll see what makes my new toy play music. Here, what should I try? All right, well, what if I squish it, and then I squeeze it here, and then I pull this ring. Oh! It's amazing! Should I try that again? Alright. I'll squish it. And then I'll squeeze it here. And then I'll pull this ring. Yay! I think I should try something else. I'll try something else. What if I squish it? And then I shake it. And then I pull this ring. Do you hear anything? No, I don't hear anything either.
Okay, now once again, you can see that that's a pretty complicated series of events to follow. She does that 10 more times, and the child is watching it. But the 4-year-old seemed to get it, because here's what... Oops. Here's what...
I'm trying to go.
Wait, I'm trying to go. The intelligent solution. Now, we then went and we did this experiment a slightly different way. As you can see, Daphne, my graduate student, who was an MIT computer scientist, was very good at being clueless, and she was being very clueless when she was introducing that toy, not knowing how it worked. We did exactly the same experiment, but this time Daphne said, "This is my toy. I'm going to show you how my toy works." So in other words, she acted like a teacher trying to demonstrate something to the child. And when she did that, the children never got the creative intelligence solution. What they did was imitate exactly what it was that she had done. So actually seeing a teacher demonstrating had the effect, paradoxically, of narrowing the range of possibilities that the children were willing to consider. And in some ways, that's a very sensible thing for the children to do. If the teacher was going to explain something to you, then she'd show you the way that it worked. Teaching is a kind of double-edged sword. It enables children to get to the teacher solution more quickly, but it may keep them from exploring more widely. So these experiments, and there are many others, suggest that children's natural tendency is to be these creative, innovative, incredibly intelligent problem solvers. And that the kind of scholastic attitude we have with direct instruction can actually narrow the range of solutions they find. Why are children so creative? Well, working evolutionary biology suggests that this may be the very function of childhood. So one of the things that's most distinctive about us humans is that we have this exceptionally long period of childhood, this exceptionally long period of protected immaturity. And more people think the reason why we have that period is so that we can have a period when all we have to do is learn, explore, innovate, be creative. We don't have the pressures of actually going out into the world and making things happen. And there's a kind of intrinsic tension between those two kinds of ways of being in the world. If we just want to get to the solution as quickly as possible, we should do the obvious thing, the simple thing. If what we want to do is find solutions we've never found before, we should explore. But in order to do that, we have to be in a protected space where we're not worried about what's going to happen to us in the next few minutes. And evolution seems to have designed children and childhood to solve that tension. We get this early period where we can explore, we can innovate, and then we can take the things that we found out in that early childhood period and put them to use later on as adults. So childhood is for this kind of learning. But unfortunately, at the moment, I think there's actually a pressure in the opposite direction. So preschool teachers, early childhood educators, people in children's museums, I think intuitively have known for a long time what the science has only just been proving and demonstrating scientifically, that children learn by playing, by being in a rich environment, by exploration. But increasingly, those early childhood educators are caught in a kind of pincer movement between parents on the one hand who want their children to grow up to go to Harvard, and or Berkeley maybe, and administrators, on the other hand, who want to prove that they got a good bang from their buck from their investment in things like early childhood education programs or children's museums. So there's increasing pressure to take the model school and push it back younger and younger and younger. So the first grade now looks more like second grade used to, kindergarten and preschool look more and more like schools do. And the research suggests that that's exactly the opposite of what we should be doing. It's exactly the opposite of what children were designed to do. And it's interesting that if you look at the evolutionary background, the impetus for developing this long childhood, our large brain, our capacities for learning and innovation and culture, was the fact that the climate changed. Things became much less predictable. Things became much more variable. And that period of childhood really seems to be designed to deal with the unexpected, the new, the things that you don't know are going to happen, the unknown unknowns. That's what having a protected period for exploration gives you. And of course, that's even more true for us now than it was at the time that we evolved. In a world that's changing quickly, where things are unpredictable, where we don't know what's going to happen next, those natural abilities for innovation, for creativity and exploration that we see in childhood, those things are more important than they were in the past, not less important than they were in the past. So if we want children to continue as adults to be able to deal with a changing environment, if as human beings we want to take advantage of this protective period, what we need to do is give children more opportunities to explore and play, not put them in school earlier and earlier and earlier. So the moral is, if we want to really take advantage of these distinctive human abilities to explore and create, and the distinctive childhood goes with them, we have to stop thinking that what we need to do is make children learn, and realize that all we have to do is let children learn.
So the implications are there not only...
The implications of what she's saying are not only there for children, and the way we're constraining the human ability to innovate and create by trying to turn our children into adults at younger and younger ages, and therefore losing those abilities that nature wired into our children, gave to our children, that we lost because we get schooled out of them. Okay? So not only are we doing the wrong thing by our children, but in terms of our own thinking, if we want to be truly creative and innovative, we need to become more like children are in our own minds. We need to somehow let go of the knowing what is right or true or good, or will be successful, and we need to allow our creative consciousness to somehow reemerge from wherever it was buried in school. You understand? This is a hugely important talk. This is, the most popular TED talk of all time is Ken Robinson's talk about the schools kill creativity. This is that talk updated. Gloria, and then I'll dismiss.
Spencer, I love you so much. You give all the sides of this coin. You show us all the different possibilities without cramming one theory down our mouth versus another. You're the only guy who does this. I mean, maybe there's other out in the world, but so thank you. But now I know, I can't believe it. I'm so thrilled. Now I know why I hate the fact that my generation is the one that forced their kids in these preschools and private schools, and now we have one of the worst public school systems in the world, because our kids can't do stuff.
Right.
And
so I just want to make, I just got, okay, one a comment and then one last point to make. So yeah, what's your first name?
Shirley.
Sure.
I just don't see how this is different from problem-solving learning, discovery learning, Steiner schools, Montessori schools. I mean, this has been around. What's new? I didn't get it. I didn't get what's new.
So, what she's arguing is those places are outposts in the general cultural progression away from those kinds of approaches. The pressures to make your kid at 3 years old go to a school that's going to make her or him learn so quickly that they'll get to Harvard. So, Jeanette, can we laugh at
What
trust that if children, you know, having been in preschools for 3 years, that when we honor our innate sense of trust, instead of giving the authority to a teacher to create a reality, yeah, you need some guidance sometimes in different things, but the child does not learn fear. A child learns fear from the environment. And children naturally are interested, they're open to creativity, but the younger years are more about control. And it relates to the mystical experiences that if we give up control and trust that there's a bigger picture, how does that work with spirituality? It's more of a trust in the unknown.
You took the words right out of my mouth, so you're perfect. So the three comments all weave together. The theme that underlay today's class is, and the whole what we're doing is, we're just trying to open ourselves. We're just trying to open our minds so that we can apprehend things that we, in a closed way, don't see. So in school, in progressive schools, in life in general, when we investigate spirituality, what we need to do is just keep opening to possibilities, opening to possibilities. So I hope that this week is a week of opening to possibilities. See you next week.